Bonjour tout le monde, bienvenue. Merci d'être là pour donc cette deuxième conférence de Pool Nurse. Je vais passer en anglais comme la dernière fois, comme ça il comprendra ce que j'ai dit. So in this lecture, his second lecture of the series, Pool is going to explore the question of life. What is life? And as we're in the Collège de France, I thought I should maybe just say one word about others who've thought about the concept of life. I won't say much, but, you know, Michel Foucault, for example, thought a lot about what is life at the center of politics, and reading a little bit about what's happening today in the world, I think it would be very timely to revisit Foucault and his thoughts on what life is today. But I'm going to turn to Paul, who is thinking about the basic principles of life and what they mean. And much of, I think, his presentation will be about the cell, which is the unit of life. But what is it actually about? What does that mean? What does life represent? And I think what Paul will be exploring with us is what is living and what isn't. You know, faced with a pandemic where we have a virus that raged, is a virus a living entity or not? And what is it about life that, you know, allows the propagation of our species amongst others? So I won't say very much more, but I think that the book that Paul wrote and published last year under this very title, What is Life? I actually bought it in St. Pancras Station one day when I was on my way back to Paris. And I actually read it. And I did actually learn something, a lot actually. And I won't go through the various principles that Paul evokes in there, but I realized that this wasn't the first book on life that had been written. There have been a couple of others, one by Haldane and one by Schrödinger. And I note that when Watson and Crick discovered the double helix, or helped to understand the double helix of DNA, they actually wrote to Schrödinger in 1953 to say that they'd both been influenced by your little book, as they put it. So, Paul, I'm sure that your little book will inspire many new thoughts and investigations, and we're looking forward to watching the Nobel Prizes that will emerge from those that read it. And I recommend it. It's published in several languages, I think, and I'm sure that you will be telling us about what the next chapters will be, too. So, Paul, thank you so much for being here. It's really an honour and a pleasure.
Thank you, Edith. Thank you for that introduction. And thank you all for coming out on not the nicest day and for braving the wet weather here. Reminds me of London, actually. I am indeed going to talk about what is life. It also, of course, I'm not the first person to ask the question, and I will refer at least to Schrödinger briefly during my talk. It is one of the fundamental questions in biology. You could almost say it is the fundamental question in biology. It's an easy question to ask, not so easy to answer, and I will not give you a satisfactory answer, but I hope I will give you an answer that will interest you. Where do we start? We start with the bewildering diversity of life as we know it on this planet. All around us are bacteria, fungi, plants, insects, other animals, including, of course, ourselves, human beings. The living organisms that we find here, found on Earth, are, of course, physical entities. They maintain themselves, they grow, they self-organize, they reproduce. But what is it that links all this extraordinary diversity together? And I've put up here one example of life. It's a yellow brimstone butterfly. I like insects. And this butterfly flits about our gardens in early spring. So the question I'm asking really is, what is it that links butterflies like this to all other living things on the planet, including ourselves? And that's the question I want to address this evening. And through that, what are the core principles, as Edith has said, that underlie life, that define life? As Edith has said, this question has been looked at by others. This is the title of page of... Now, I had this problem last time. Let's see. Yes, this is the title page of the book to which she referred, What is Life? By the famous physicist Erwin Schrödinger. It's the only piece that he really wrote in the life sciences. He wrote it in 1944. It was quite influential at the beginning of molecular biology, influential for me when I first read it, which I have to say is now half a century ago. Hate saying that, but half a century ago. And I will quote a couple of passages from it a bit later. My approach to the same question that Schrödinger asked is to consider, it's a different approach from his, is to consider some of the most important ideas of biology, five ideas I'm going to talk about. And I want to start by saying biologists don't talk enough about ideas. Physicists love it, okay? Physicists are always writing books about ideas, usually the same ideas, it has to be said, in various forms. Us biologists seem to like to think and describe particulars. You know, how many hairs there were on a beetle's leg, if I was Darwin, or the sequence of a gene today. We like descriptions, we like particulars. But we do have great ideas, and five of them I'm going to talk about this evening. And the first is, again, as Edith has anticipated, is the cell, biology's atom, the concept of the cell. The cell is the basic structural and functional unit of life. It is indeed life's atoms. They were first described by Robert Hooke in the 1660s, in Oxford, actually, which is where I live, or at least at the weekends where I live, at the very beginning of the Royal Society, where he was experimentalist. And what he did is, using a microscope similar to the one you see on the left there, he took a piece of cork, took a thin slice of it, looked at it under the microscope, and you see the illustration on the left there, which he drew and published in a book called Micrographia. I put a scanning EM on the right to show what it would look like today. And what he saw is what you see here, and it's neat arrays of boxes. And he called them cells after the Latin word cella for small cubicle, that's the origin of cells, the first discovery of it. A few years later, the Dutch draper Antony van Leeuwenhoek, working in Delft, scraped between his teeth, put it under his rather improved microscopes, and discovered single-celled life, bacteria. He sent this drawing to the recently established, then I should say, Royal Society in London, and amongst his letters includes this one here, with the charming image of, at least I find it charming, of a bacterium doing a loop-the-loop under fig B. See how it goes, big C to D, swimming about under the microscope. Leeuwenhoek was a bit disturbed by all of this, by the way, because he was rather proud of his dental hygiene. And to discover little animals, as he thought of them, swimming about between his teeth was a bit disturbing. Turns out Leeuwenhoek was a close neighbour in Delft to the painter Vermeer, who, unusually for the times, painted scientists, two pictures, one of which is in the Louvre, by the way. This is one of them. You can see it here. He painted a geographer and astronomer. I forget which one this is. They've both got globes. One is of the stars, the other is of the a planet. I like to think this might be Leeuwenhoek. There is not one piece of evidence, actually, that's good for that, but I like to think it. It is true, though, that when Vermeer died, which he did in his early 40s, Leeuwenhoek was the executor of his will, so there was some sort of relationship. This is in the 1670s to the 1680s. It took probably another two centuries for this concept of the soul to develop further, when it became clear that all living organisms consist either of a single cell or of a collection of cells, such as our cells. This conclusion was summarized by Theodor Schwann, a German zoologist, in the first part of the 19th century. In 1839, he wrote in German, translated here in English, "We have seen that all organisms are composed of essentially like parts, namely of cells." In other words, the cell is the basic structural unit of all life. But as well as being the structural unit, as I've already said, they are also the basic functional unit of life. This was argued by another German pathologist, the origin of pathology really, Rudolf Virchow, a little later. Again in German, translated here into English, "Every animal appears as a sum of vital units, each of which bears within itself the complete characteristics of life." That, therefore, is his definition of the functional unit of life. And he added to that something that's quite important, that all cells come from cells, omnicellular, acellular. And this means, apart from the fact that it pushes back on vitalism, which was still being considered and discussed at the time, it also means, if you think more about it, that there's been a stream of connection between cell generations through the process of cell division, which stretches back through the development of individual animals and plants and other organisms, and then to generations before that, extending ultimately into deep time through the evolution of life on this planet. It's in fact a very deep concept. Now, I hope I've convinced you that cells are interesting, but if I have not, I want to show you this picture here, which is sperm trying to fertilize an oocyte to make an egg, and remind all of you that once you looked just like this. All of you came from a single cell, and if you're not interested now, there's two doors at the back, and it's probably best now you leave, because it doesn't get more interesting than that. All of us were once a cell. Now, cells are generally considered to be the simplest entities which exhibit the characteristics of life. I will talk about viruses later, which is, of course, an interesting question in this context. Therefore, given that, the means of understanding cells is key also to understanding life. In other words, in a very fundamental way, if we can understand what it is about a cell that makes it living, we do understand life. And the advantage of dealing with a cell is it is rather simpler than more complex living entities such as ourselves. And that is why I shall focus most of my attention on cells and how they work. Now, cells, they are, this is a modern picture of a cell, they're bounded physical entities. I want to say that so that when I'm asked about computer programs and if they are alive, I can already push back on that. They are bounded physical entities. Note what I said there. Physical entities separated from their environment, surrounded by a semi-permeable surface, a lipid membrane, in fact, which separates them from their surroundings but allows communication with those surroundings. Now, this separation allows order to be built up inside cells at the expense of increasing disorder outside the cells. And this arrangement means that, of course, life does not contravene the second law of thermodynamics, which states that the universe as a whole is moving towards disorder. I mention this because this is something often troubles physicists thinking about life, and indeed troubled Schrödinger. But it is not really an issue. Schrödinger did mention this here. This is two quotes from him. "An organism's astonishing gift of controlling a stream of order on itself and thus escaping the decay into atomic chaos. It does indeed escape it. It is to do with order, but it isn't a challenge to the second law of thermodynamics, so we can relax about that. The second sentence I extracted from his book is a connection to the next idea I want to discuss with you, and that is these chromosomes. He was talking about chromosomes, which are common, of course, to all cells, contain in some kind of code script the entire pattern of the individual's future development and functioning. And this is an introduction to the next idea I want to talk about, which is the gene, and how the gene explains the mysterious phenomenon of inheritance. Now, this is the idea of the gene as the basis of heredity. And it had its origins with the work of the Augustinian monk, Gregor Mendel, shown here, who became abbot of Brno Monastery in what is now the Czech Republic, but was then the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And he published his experiments about this in 1865, in the middle of the 19th century. And he tackled the problem of inheritance by carrying out many crosses of pea plants, which exhibited different characteristics, and then analysing the outcomes of the progeny, and these were thousands of progeny, which were formed in these crosses. And I visited his monastery, actually in 1981, when I was almost a child, and visited the monastery just to see where he did this work. And this was his garden. This was I got this photograph when I was there in 1981. And you'll see it was actually quite a big garden. And if I were to tell you that in addition to this garden, he had a greenhouse that was a similar size, you sort of realise that what we were looking at in this monastery was actually a research institute in the middle of the 19th century. And sometimes we don't fully appreciate that the origins of very important concepts in science have come from unexpected sources. In this particular case, of course, from a monastic order which was devoted to teaching local high schools, in fact, students, but also had a great interest in research as well, and were prepared to fund the research by building gardens and greenhouses for discovery research. Note that funding organisations in this country and every other country in the world. Anyway, this was Mendel's garden. He crossed various different types of pea plants, and some examples are shown here. They were tall ones, short ones, different coloured flowers, different types of a seed shape. By the way, before he decided to work on pea plants, he did preliminary experiments with about five or six other species, and his preliminary work, he could make no sense of it at all. So he took the bold step of simply abandoning them and forgetting about it and only working on the one system that he could make some sense of, which was pea plants. Now, this sounds like cheating. And of course, it is a bit like cheating. But had he immersed himself in all the complexities of the other plants where the characteristics turned out to be determined by multiple genes and therefore completely incomprehensible, he would never have made progress. There's a lesson for us there, and that lesson is work on biological material that you might have a hope of understanding, and if you understand that, you might then be able to project it elsewhere where it's more complicated. So don't get too sniffy about people selecting models that they can understand. He famously observed simple ratios in these characteristics in the progeny produced by these crosses, famous ratios like 3-1. I don't want to explain these. You can read about these if you are interested. And these eventually led to what's called Mendelism. Has to be said, Mendel didn't quite invent Mendelism, but he laid the framework which led to Mendelism 30 years later. And this is really the idea that heredity is based on indivisible particles or factors that are inherited through the germ cells, that is, in plants, the pollen and the ovules, sperm and eggs in animals. And it's this particular behaviour, of course, which accounts for the simple ratios. You can sort of see that conceptually if I don't even explain it. And ultimately, these factors were found to be linked to the chromosomes, which were discovered a little later, actually, 20, 30 years later, as shown here. This is a late 19th century illustration of chromosomes in dividing root tip cells. Must be said, I also saw chromosomes for the first time at school that were in dividing root tip cells as well. It also should be said, most of you probably know this, that Mendel's work was not recognised at the time. It was laid fallow. It was rediscovered by three plant scientists at the beginning of the 20th century who were probably mildly irritated to find that their work had been anticipated by the gardening monk 35 years earlier. But important discovery made by Mendel, but then turned into Mendelism, in fact, by those three plant geneticists 30, 40 years later. The Mendelian hereditary factors are what we would now call genes. In the 1940s, Oswald Avery, working in Rockefeller University, New York, which I also have worked in myself, showed that these genes were likely to be made of deoxyribonucleic acid, or DNA. It was actually very contentious at the time. His own colleagues at Rockefeller were amongst the fiercest critics of this conclusion because they thought DNA was too simple. I'll comment a little bit more on that a little bit later. And he was heavily criticised by his own colleagues, who sometimes in academic circles are not always collegiate, despite being colleagues. The structure of DNA, and again, you heard Edith comment on that, as a double helix was established 10 years later. Work from London by Rosalind Franklin, Ryan Gosling and Maurice Wilkins, in Cambridge by Francis Crick and Jim Watson. Crick and Watson famously argued that the double helical structure of DNA could explain heredity through the linear sequence of bases making up DNA. And I'll say a little more, some more about that later. Here what we see is the DNA and the chromosomes coming from, the nucleus in the cell, the chromosomes there, being unraveled and magnified until you can see double helix appearing, which is seen now in the more conventional picture here of the picture of DNA as a twisted ladder, as you can see at the top. Now, when the rungs of that ladder, which are made up of the links between complementing bases, which pair each other, when those rungs are split, so the bases are separated, then they can be copied, as you see here, to produce two new identical helices. In other words, each of those single chains acts as a template for new strands. This, of course, very simply, and this is what Watson and Crick fully recognise, this explains how the DNA is copied during cell reproduction and is the basis of heredity. It also, of course, coincides with Schrödinger's code script and the permanence of the gene between generations, because DNA is precisely copied every time a cell divides. The sequence of bases encoding the genetic information is kept stable in the middle of that DNA polymer double helix. Crick and others went on to propose what we now call, or he named, the central dogma, showing here. And what this describes is how the sequence of bases that make up a gene in DNA, at the top part there, is copied or transcribed from DNA to ribonucleic acid, or RNA, and that acts as a messenger from the nucleus to the cytoplasm, from the where the chromosomes are located in the nucleus, to the cytoplasm where the proteins are made. And the sequence of messenger RNA determines the primary sequence, and that's shown at the bottom here, of the structure of proteins. And I shall expand a little bit more on that a little later. But this led to the conclusion, actually based on quite clever fungal genetics, is that there's one gene that encodes for each protein. One gene, one protein. Now, these discoveries were made in the second half of the 20th century, and they laid the foundations for molecular biology. And these are critical for understanding life. Central to this is the genetic code. The genetic code is written in four letters made of the four bases, adenine, thymine, cytosine, and guanine, with information stored in a linear form. And this way of storing information is the same as sentences in a book, the words I am speaking here, which are also linear in form, or bytes in a computer, which are also in a linear form. It, of course, means that the linear digital storage of information was invented by life at the dawn of life over 3 billion years ago before the computer age. We humans don't discover all that much which is new, it seems. The nature and function of the gene introduces me to the two next ideas I want to talk about, and these are life as chemistry and, subsequent to that, life as information. The first of these, life as chemistry, is simply stated. That is, that the basis of life is determined by chemical activity and physical forces, and the functioning of living organisms depend upon that. Now, the origin of this idea can be traced back to French chemists. There was initial work by the famous chemist Lavoisier, the father of chemistry, who unfortunately his experiments were interrupted by being beheaded during the revolution. We scientists have to be a bit suspicious of politicians, by the way, because you can lose your head if you're not careful. But after that initial work, it was Louis Pasteur, the brilliant Louis Pasteur shown here, carrying out experiments on sugar beet fermentation in the north of France, which led to the concept that life is based on chemistry. What he was doing was applied work, in analysing the fermentation of sugar beet to make alcohol, a project he was asked to do at the request of industrialists up there, because I think it was somewhere around Lille, when I say up there, by the way, because the fermentations of the sugar beet sometimes failed, and instead of making alcohol, they made acid instead. He demonstrated that the successful production of alcohol required the activity of a single-celled living organism in the fermentation, which was yeast. And he established that the yeast cell produced substances that made alcohol from the sugar, which was derived from the sugar beet. And if the yeast was not there, then probably bacteria that was there instead of producing alcohol, produced acid, so the fermentation went bad. So he could advise the industrialists, I don't know how much money he got from them, but he could advise the industrialists, if you put yeast in there, it will work. And that was the simple answer. But he was a great scientist as well, as providing industrial solutions, and he concluded more generally that fermentation, I quote here, this time from the French, fermentation, translated into English, fermentation was a physiological act yielding products for the cell. Chemical reactions are an expression of the life of the cell. In other words, he built this broad generalization, this broad idea, based on his sugar beet fermentation observations. And in other words, what this meant is that life is chemistry. But it is an extraordinary chemistry, and an elaborate and special chemistry, which I now want to spend a few minutes describing to you, a chemistry based upon carbon polymers. Now, we've already met carbon polymers that make up the nucleic acids DNA and RNA, and now I want to consider in a little more detail the carbon polymers that make up proteins. Carbon, that is so central to life, by the way, has its origins in the centres of dying stars. That's where carbon comes from. We literally have our origins in the stars. And it's one of the more common elements, not the most common element, but one of them in the universe. Now, the substances from yeast that Pasteur postulated are, in fact, proteins. And these proteins act as enzymes which catalyze chemical reactions. Proteins are polymers of amino acids based upon carbon and nitrogen. The carbon atoms form part of the backbone. The backbone is the sort of lower line there to the polymer, which link the side chains of the amino acids. And you see a structure here. What you can also see is that there's 20 different amino acids in normal life. And I put five up here, which have different side chains that introduce different chemical properties. And that's critical for what I should be saying in a few minutes. They can be positively charged, negatively charged, repel water, or attract water. And it's these chemical differences that produce the elaborate chemistry that it can take place in cells. If we look at the that structure a little bit more, you can see clearly the carbon and nitrogen backbone, and then different amino terminals, side chains, which are represented by these letters R that you saw on the previous slide. The result of all of this is a wide variety of chemistry that can produce elaborate structures which carry out many and varied chemical reactions. This contrasts with DNA. DNA is boring. It's stable and boring chemically. It's not chemically diverse. Indeed, it's this dullness, which is why Avery's colleagues at Rockefeller opposed his ideas. It was just too simple to be true. But the chains of amino acids making up protein polymers can fold up in many ways. And this is a chain, as you can see, of amino acids, a couple of hundred or so there. And that the properties of these different chemical components in different places in that chain can result in a three-dimensional structure, shown here made up of different billiard balls, and the billiard balls are coloured in different colours to indicate that there are different chemical entities in different places in the molecule. And it's this chemical richness which is the reason why there are so many enzymes that can carry out so many different chemical reactions, because this is hugely varied. In short, these proteins are chemical machines. These machines produce a huge range of different chemicals which are required for living things to work. They make new molecules, they can break molecules down, they can recycle them, they can generate complex, larger assemblies which can synthesize polymers of nucleic acid, protein, lipid, and carbohydrates. These chemical machines can also do physical work. They can make motors, which carry cargoes around the cell on protein-based trackways, like little railway tracks. They can act in hybrid ways, combining chemistry and physics, allowing energy to be captured from sunlight, or breaking down sugars to produce energy-rich chemicals that can drive the activities of cells. And all of this activity means, and I just want you to really concentrate on this, all this means there are thousands of chemical reactions being carried out simultaneously in a cell and in close juxtaposition next door to many other chemical reactions, all of which require somewhat different microenvironments and chemical conditions to work. A small sample of the complexity of this is shown here. Each of these dots, and this is central metabolism in a cell, those who are familiar with this, the red circle at the bottom is the Krebs cycle, for example, And all of these, there's a couple of hundred red dots on here, are different chemical reactions all occurring in the same cell at the same time, close to each other. And this is not just hundreds, there will be thousands. Now, because these reactions require different chemical conditions, they do have to be separated one from the other. And this is achieved by compartmentation within the cell, brought about by surfaces and folds of the enzymes, by complexes of several enzymes acting together, and by higher order structures, such as membrane-bounded organelles, visible here in that picture of the cell I showed you, which has been schematized here, emphasizing the different compartments. And what I want to emphasize is we tend to look at cells not exactly statically when you see structures, but what you're actually looking at when you look at the structure of a cell is a huge diversity of chemical microenvironments, each establishing different chemical microenvironments, allowing different chemistries to be carried out. However, that chemistry, if it's to have a purpose, must act together as a whole. It can't just be a random set of chemical reactions. It has to be organized together. And that requires communication and coordination between these different chemical microenvironments and compartments and everything that's going on there. And that communication involves the transfer of information. And information transfer is the next idea I want to talk about, which is life as information. So this is the next fundamental idea. And within this is various sub-issues, that life is a complex system, that it has to be controlled, and it has to act as with purpose for the whole cell. Now, when I read the background to this, to where these ideas came from, and you'll notice I'm always going back to where the ideas came from, and what's surprising is how most of the fundamental ideas of biology are really rather ancient. I've talked about the 17th century, 18th century, and 19th century, with the exception of the structure of DNA, they are quite old. And the idea that life is a complex system, I discovered, was first described in some detail by the philosopher Immanuel Kant in a book on moral philosophy. Quite what it's doing there, I'm not quite sure. But he was analysing living things, particularly human beings, and arguing that they were a complex system, and a complex system that we would now say is based on the management of information. Now, I'm going to give two examples, one of which you've met already, to illustrate. And the first of these is, once again, the structure of DNA. Now, the structure of DNA is iconic. We all know about it. It's almost boring to us now. You go into any biological, biomedical institute and you'll see some sculpture or whatever of DNA. It drives me crazy, I have to say. But that's what you see. It is iconic. It is beautiful. But the real beauty in it lies in the fact that it only makes proper sense when it's recognized what this represents is a digital information storage device. That's what it is. One that is written in the linear script of four letters that we've already discussed. And that is beautiful, and it's a beautiful idea. The linear polymer of DNA is ideal for storing information, which I've already mentioned to you, with the encoding letter bases turned inside the helix and to some extent protected from chemical change. But even better than that, this information can be turned, though it's chemically stable there, can be turned into chemical action to do work through the varied chemical activities of the proteins which are encoded by that DNA. And for me, this is a really wonderful characteristic of life. It's all built on these carbon polymers. The ability to encode information in essentially one-dimensional linear structures, and for that to be transcribed and translated into three-dimensional structures in the proteins, which are capable of doing chemical and physical work. And this requires information to be transferred from the DNA to the protein from a stable structure chemically, which is not chemically interesting, to proteins which are much more varied and can do chemical work. The second idea of information that I want to be important for life is concerned with the... Let's stop you concentrating on that because I haven't actually explained what it is. We'll go back to this. It's how do we make a complex system act as a whole in living organisms? How do we make it work with purpose? And it helps here to turn to the metaphor of man-made machines, because we know why they've been designed that way. And a familiar one is this one, the governor, developed by James Watt, though it was actually used 100 years before James Watt in windmills, to regulate steam engines. I have to say, I always have to turn to examples from machines made before 1900, because after that, I never really understand them. But everything before works quite well, and this is an example. This is a governor. I took a picture of it in New Zealand in a boat built in 1896. And what happens, of course, is as the engine goes fast, so those balls swing out, that shuts off the steam to the to the engine, then as a consequence, the engine slows down, the balls go back in again, that switches on the steam. This leads to homeostasis, to regulation, to maintenance. It maintains a constant speed of the steam engine. This is an example of a simple example of a negative feedback loop, which you see up there, which I've drawn out here in the context of a metabolic pathway in a cell. The negative feedback loop, the top one, we have a chemical A being turned to B, being turned to C. The concentration of C determines the rate of the reaction from A to B. So when C builds up, then it can feed back on the transfer of A to B and slows that down, and you get homeostasis. Beautiful, simple, negative feedback control. This was first demonstrated in by a brilliant French scientist, geneticist, François Jacob and Jacques Monod, studying gene regulation of sugar metabolism in bacteria. Now, other control models lead to positive feedback, as you see there. It's, as C builds up, it actually promotes A to B, and therefore this leads, of course, if you think about it, to an irreversible switch. Now, in cells, there are many such feedbacks and control modules operating. They maintain homeostasis, they generate switches, timers, toggles, oscillators, translating chemistry into informational modules. And these can then be linked together to generate even more elaborate routines of informational management and processing. And a metaphor for all of this is an electronic circuit. Some wit here, those of you who are familiar with cancer genes will see that that somebody put labels on a transistor radio's circuit of different oncogenes to emphasize that what we have here is a network of components interacting each other in a complex circuit. So this metaphor of a hardwired system is useful, but perhaps a better metaphor for living systems is, rather than hardware, is the term wetware, which was invented by a systems biologist called Bray, because the components in the cell can be linked together and relinked together in different ways, communicating by solution chemistry, because you're transmitting information from one component to another through solution rather than hardwired together. And this obviously will increase the versatility of control modules, and also, I'm afraid so far, is completely understudied, but I'm sure will turn out to be important. So the management of life's chemistry by information allows the behaviour of a complex system to act as a whole with overall purpose. I'm using that word because I think it might promote some questions. I'm not thinking of the word purpose as in the human brain. I'm thinking that it behaves as a whole. The cell is behaving as a whole. A purpose such as reproducing itself, making a butterfly, or maintaining ourselves. Now, for centuries, generating purposeful behaviours was thought to require a designer, a divine creator. And it took evolution by natural selection to change this, and this is my final idea, how living things came about. Now, this beautiful idea is mainly credited to Charles Darwin. It's a bit more complicated than that, and I'll comment briefly on it. The idea has two parts. The first is that life evolves. That actually wasn't Darwin's idea. It had been around for a century or even longer before that. The second, but he did provide the good evidence for it. The second is that the major mechanism for evolution is natural selection. So they're the two ideas. Now, I got up here Erasmus and Charles Darwin. On the right, the rather stiff-looking Charles, in this case, Erasmus on the left, his grandfather. That life was evolved, as I've said, was discussed in the century before Charles by, for example, Jean-Baptiste Lamarck, who made a lot of interesting observations, and Charles' own grandfather, Erasmus. I put Erasmus up there because he was such an interesting and entertaining character who's not really fully appreciated. He was a colourful character, a scientist, a doctor, and also a poet. In fact, the majority of his research was written up in poetry. I have a number of his books published in the late 18th century, and it's all written in poetry. He's got one on the loves of plants, which is all about plant classification, and it's all about these plants falling in love with each other in poems. He was also a Republican, refused to become the medical attendant for George III, for example, who was king at the time. He was a proponent of women's education and helped set up a public school for women. And although he had an absolutely terrible stammer, was a great conversationalist. So a really eccentric sort of person. He also argued for the evolution of life, suggesting that simple, formless mollusks could evolve into complex animals. That got him into trouble, by the way, because he painted on his carriage all things from shells to reflect that. But he lived close to the cathedral in Lichfield, and the dean of the cathedral did not like this and told his richer patients, from whom he got all his income, that they shouldn't go to this atheist who was teaching all this stuff. So he had to remove his motto. He painted it out. Now, the evolution of life, that idea implies that there is a tree of life, that living organisms are all related one to another. Now, if life only arose, or at least only arose and survived once, as seems likely given the conserved chemistry and coding found in all living things, then all life on Earth is related. This was captured in the only diagram in Darwin's Origin of Species, published in 1859, which is the first tree of life that you can see there. He was a bit uncertain about the origins of life, which you'll see at the bottom there go from A to L, is, of course, quite interesting, though most of them didn't actually go anywhere. But you do end up with more than one life surviving up till today. He gathered evidence in favour of life evolving through natural selection, the second idea, during his trip around the world in the Beagle, this boat that was mapping particularly the South American coast, and he was the naturalist on it. Now, he proposed natural selection as a mechanism. And I'll briefly summarise it. It's a consequence of populations of, say, a particular species exhibiting variations caused by inheritable genetic changes. These can be caused by mistakes made when DNA is copied or if DNA is damaged by external causes such as sunlight, radiation. If these variants influence characteristics that make those organisms reproduce more, then that particular genetic variation will spread in subsequent generations through the population. It's a beautiful idea, it's incredibly simple. Because over time, such genetic variations will accumulate and lead to changes in the population such that the individuals of that population will no longer be able to breed with the original population, origin of species. And that leads to a new species which is better adapted and is more successful in survival and reproduction. Darwin came to this view partly in his study of finches on the Galapagos Islands. These are illustrations of the finches that he described there. The Galapagos are recently arising in geological history. I stole this from a book somewhere where you see on the right pliers that are also specialised for different purposes. So are a different analogy. They are all adapted to what they have to do. The finches' beaks, whether they're breaking nuts or catching insects under bark, or the pliers, which also are specialised. The difference is those on the right are intelligently designed, and those on the left have been designed, in inverted commas, by natural evolution, by natural selection. And therefore, you can produce apparent adaption without a divine creator. Now, as I've explained, for natural selection to take place, and I'm going to be now more specific about it, three things are needed. You have to have a living thing that can reproduce. That living thing needs to have a heredity system. And thirdly, that heredity system needs to exhibit variability upon which selection can work. Those are the three basic requirements for evolution by natural selection to work. And I'm going to show you how that can all work based simply on the ideas of the cell and the gene, which I've already introduced to you. So I want you to imagine a simple single-celled life form which has got a brown cell coat at the top there, the colour of which is determined by a gene on its chromosomes, which are inside the purple nucleus. Imagine as the cell divides and copies its DNA, it makes a mistake so that the cell coat is altered, and now the cell makes a red coat, as you see in the bottom right, instead of a brown coat. Also imagine that the red-coated cells perhaps survive better. Maybe they don't taste good to a predator. And as a consequence, the red cells will gradually replace the brown cells in the population, and we have, albeit simple evolution, but evolution by natural selection. And it links together, as you've seen, the concept of the cell and the gene and evolution by natural selection. This is a profoundly important idea in biology, so much so that the 20th century geneticist Hermann Muller used it to define life. He defined life as simply living things have properties which allow them to undergo natural selection and therefore to evolve. And this definition will feature in a few minutes with my starting point for principles. But before doing that, I want to say goodbye to Darwin. This is him as an old man, and I want to read out the monumental sentences that end The Origin of Species, written up there. Whilst this planet has gone cycling on according to the fixed law of gravity, from so simple a beginning, endless forms, most beautiful and most wonderful, have been and are being evolved. Why can't we write papers like that anymore? I've never written a sentence anything like that, and if I did, the editor would scrap it out for sure. We have to learn how to just write something that will stand the test of time. I could rage about it, but I'll move on. What he was doing here is note that he was relating his work in the life sciences to physics, to the great physicist Isaac Newton with the law of gravity, and therefore arguing that biology indeed has fundamental laws just like physics, We just need to discuss them more. Let me now return at the end of this talk to what is life, using the five ideas I've discussed with you to try and get further insight into life. I'm going to try and generate a few principles, but they are rather verbose, and I need to warn you they do not lead to a neat dictionary-like definition of life. But I can summarise them on these several slides. Firstly, living things are independent, bounded, physical entities. So we can get rid of computer games, right? They are separated from their environment, but are in communication with their environment. This separation allows them to generate order and organisation at the expense of increased disorder beyond their boundaries. The basic unit of life on Earth, on planet Earth, is the cell, and all multicellular organisms are aggregates of cells. Secondly, living things are chemical, physical, and informational machines. They construct their own chemical metabolism. This is used to build and maintain themselves, to grow, to reproduce, to maintain themselves, and integration of all these functions requires the management of information. Inputs are gathered from within and outside the cell, are processed, stored, and used to instruct the operations of cells and organisms. Third slide. I've just explained Hermann Muller's idea that life forms are entities that undergo evolution or are capable of undergoing evolution by natural selection. By doing so, they acquire purpose. They are entities that build, maintain, and reproduce themselves, and living things can evolve because they have the attributes that I described to you of reproduction, hereditary system, and one that exhibits variability. And I want to simply argue, put all of this together, these principles define something that is alive versus something that is not alive. So any entity which operates according to the last three slides can be deemed to be alive. Now, should we ever encounter life elsewhere in the universe, and I'm sure there is life elsewhere in the universe, whether we ever encounter it is a different question, but should we do so, I suspect it will be built on the same principles. The details may well be different. Certainly the chemical basis may be different. However, in my opinion, for it to readily serve the need for both long-term information storage and diverse chemistry, then I think it will be based on polymers that allow the encoding of digital information that can be translated into other polymers capable of chemical activity. I feel that is a fundamental principle. Living things also require energy to work, and that can come from nuclear reactions within the stars, sunlight, and heat, or from geothermal energy within the planets. Let me say just a little bit more about this polymer chemistry. I want to bang on about it because I think it is something amazing about life. The polymers produce the linear DNA information storage devices and the protein-based chemical and physical machines. Living things on Earth are related by common descent and are closely interconnected and dependent upon other things. And I'm going to pick that up in a moment when I discuss viruses. This extraordinary form of chemistry that underpins life does require emphasis. A central feature of it being built around large polymer molecules is that DNA can encode information and is a long-term reliable storage of that information, as we've seen here, and it shelters the information within itself. But this information in DNA will remain hidden and inert and needs to be transformed into action, and it does that through the chemistry, and I'll remind you, it's that chemistry there that turns the information, the dead information, into chemical work. Do you know, I cannot imagine a more elegant solution for life than this. Different configurations of linear polymers based on carbon generate both stable information, storage devices, and highly diverse chemical activities. And that's why I speculate that this is not only called to life on Earth, but also will be critical for wherever else life may be found in the universe. It is, of course, the chemistries could be different. It's possible that elsewhere in the cosmos, carbon is used in different ways, or maybe carbon isn't used at all. Silicon is another possibility, which is particularly popular with science fiction writers, by the way. Now, viruses. When thinking about what life is, it's tempting to draw a very sharp dividing line between life and non-life. Cells are clearly alive, and collections of cells, our cells, are alive too. But there are life forms, like viruses, that have a more intermediate status. Here's an example of a virus. Viruses are chemical entities. They have a DNA or RNA genome, often with a protein coat that encapsulates the virus. They can evolve by natural selection, which is why we've had so much problem with COVID, for example. So they pass Muller's test. But viruses cannot reproduce themselves, which is, of course, a characteristic that I've already emphasized. The only way they can multiply is by infecting the cells of another living organism and hijacking that metabolism. Because of that, some biologists conclude that their strict dependence on another living entity means that viruses are not truly alive. But it's important to remember that almost all other forms of life, including ourselves, are also dependent on other living things. For example, bacteria in our guts make certain amino acids that our cells cannot make by themselves. All the food we eat, essentially, is produced mostly by other living organisms. Even the most independent life forms, like cyanobacteria, which can undergo both photosynthesis and also capture nitrogen and carbon dioxide from the air, these are more independent, but nearly all living things are highly dependent. So there's a graded spectrum of living organisms that range from viruses through to the more self-sufficient cyanobacteria. I consider all these different forms to be alive because they undergo evolution by natural selection. They are simply dependent to varying degrees on other living organisms. So I don't think viruses are an extreme end, but I don't think in principle they're different. Many people wouldn't agree with that, but that's my view. If you still want a cop-out, you can just say, well, a virus is alive when it's inside the cell and dead when it's outside, and that will get rid of it as well. Now, from this broader perspective of life, that is the interdependence of life and also the relatedness of life, grows a rather richer view of the living world. Life on Earth belongs to a single, vastly interconnected ecosystem, incorporating all life. It's this fundamental connectedness. It comes from a deep interdependency, but also because all life is genetically related through its shared evolutionary roots. And this perspective of deep relatedness and deep interconnectedness is something, of course, that's been long championed by ecologists. And it's core to life, and it gives us good reason to think more deeply about the impact human activity has on the rest of the living world. Back to the tree of life, Darwin's tree of life. Organisms that live on the many branches of life's shared family tree are very varied. But that variety is frankly outshone by their greater similarities. The basic details of their operation as chemical, physical, and informational machines are the same. These deep commonalities in life's foundations point to the striking conclusion that life as it is on Earth today started and survived only once. If different life forms had emerged several times independently and had survived, it's extremely unlikely their descendants would conduct their basic operations in such a similar way. So how did it start? I don't know how it started. It's a major question, DNA, genes first, or proteins first. The best suggestion that scientists have come up, at least for me, is to say neither DNA or protein was first. Instead, it was DNA's chemical cousin RNA that came first, because RNA molecules can store information, but they can also, as well as storing information, they can have form complex three-dimensional structures that can function as enzymes. Not great enzymes, but they can do that. So RNA-based enzymes might have been the way, in fact, in which life started. But we're looking at something that happened 3.5 to 4 billion years ago, and it's difficult to be sure what was happening there. The universe is unimaginably vast. So by the laws of probability, it seems unlikely that across all that time and space, life has only ever blossomed once, right here on Earth. Whether or not we will meet alien life forms is a different issue. But if we ever do, I am confident that they will also be self-sustaining chemical and physical machines built around information encoding polymers that have been produced through evolution by natural selection. And that's the closest I'm getting to the dictionary definition. Our planet is the only corner of the universe where we know for certain life exists. The life that we are part of here on Earth is extraordinary. In spite of its bewildering diversity, scientists are making sense of it. And that understanding makes a fundamental contribution to our culture and to our civilization. Our growing understanding of what life is also has the potential to improve the lot of humankind. But this knowledge goes further. Biology shows us that all living organisms we know of are both related and closely interact. We are bound by that deep connectedness to all other life, to bacteria, to fermenting yeasts, to the yellow brimstone butterfly that I started this talk, and every other member of the biosphere, including ourselves. And together, all these species are life's great survivors. The latest descendants of a single, immeasurably vast family lineage that stretches back through an unbroken chain of cell divisions into the far reaches of deep time. But as far as we know, at least on Earth, humans are the only life forms that can see this deep connectivity, and reflect on what it might mean. In my view, this gives us a special responsibility for life on this planet, made up as it is by our relatives, some close, some more distant. We need to care about it, we need to care for it, and to do that, we need to understand it, which is what I've tried to have an attempt at this evening, and thank you very much for listening to me. Thank you.